what's up? It's El Ariel here at Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Welcome, welcome back. We can be reached at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S podcast.com. We're also on the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher Podcasts, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Android, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming podcast platforms. We would love it if you could give us some stars, give us some love, give us some feedback so we can get bumped up in the rankings, because we want as many people as possible to know about our podcast, because we are all about helping people discover how to get a career in music. And that's why we talk to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry today from all aspects of the music biz to find out exactly how they got their jobs, what decisions did they make, what choices did they face, what obstacles did they overcome, all that good stuff. So the last episode, I had the wonderful pleasure of interviewing Eric Boots Green. He is an incredibly talented drummer. He is a producer. He is a songwriter. He has toured with the likes of Jill Scott, Pharrell, Jay-Z. I mean, this man is just epic, and his career is just on fire, and he shares incredible insight and a very spiritual perspective about his musical journey. I really urge you, if you didn't get a chance, to go back and listen to it. It's just really incredible podcast interview. And now I'm really happy to invite to the podcast stage is Lauren Deacon-Davies. She is an award-winning record producer out of the UK. She won Breakthrough Engineer from Pro Sound Awards. She has won Producer of the Year 2 years in a row, 2017 and 2018, by NMG Awards. She is an artist. She is a songwriter. She can play a variety of instruments. Her artist name is Dee Dee, and she's just a badass, and I'm really excited for you guys to hear her interview. I think it will be really inspiring and very, very cool to hear what this young, incredibly talented producer has been up to. But before we do that, we are going to play one of Dee Dee's singles. This is off of her new EP called Green. This is Fickle Friends. Here we go. Never did it for the compliments. How'd you get that music job?
Hello, thank you so much for having me on board.
Yeah, let's start with the first question I always ask my guests. What's your first memories of music? Tell us what it was like to grow up in your household with music.
I think I maybe have a bit of a different experience to other kids in the music world, because my dad was a record producer for EMI, and some of my earliest memories are my mum and my dad were managing a girl band called Blush, and one of the girl band members was my babysitter.
Oh wow.
And so I just kind of got exposed to music from quite a young age, or at least like music production and music business. So yeah, my earliest memories is having random girl bands coming around and recording music at the home studio.
Oh wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, so this kind of all stemmed from elements from that part of my childhood, I guess.
Do you remember certain music being played in that? But like your parents would play certain artists or records in the house?
I honestly don't remember listening to much music other than Grange Hill. I like listened to so much, and then we always listened to that in the car, and Baggy Trousers by Madness would like just songs that I just always associate with my childhood. I was a bit of a weird kid. I didn't really like listening to music much. I was very much like, I want to be outdoors and play outside and make things, but music was never really what I wanted to do until I was about 11.
Oh, interesting. Tell us about that. What happened at 11?
My dad bought me my first guitar, and I kind of rate that he got me an electric guitar, not an acoustic guitar, because I think that it's, you know, standard. You just give a child an acoustic guitar, especially a girl, you wouldn't give them an electric to start off with. So I think that really got me into the swing of things. And naturally, I was like, oh, I'm going to start a band. So luckily, the school that I was in, there were other students there my age that had access to musical equipment and lessons and everything like that, so I had like a basic understanding of their lessons, of their instruments. Yeah, I didn't really like other people's music, so naturally I just started writing my own at like 11.
Wow. Did you teach yourself that, how to write music?
Yeah, I mean, no one taught me how to do it. The songs weren't necessarily that good, but I think I just was like, oh, I think this bit should sound like this, or I think that bit should sound like that, or it probably should repeat this bit because I want it to stick in my head. And then later in life, when I listened to more music and got into it a bit more, I was like, oh, that's like a really standard pop structure, and I didn't realize, but it's probably, you know, subliminally, you can't avoid music growing up, so I must have just been taking it in and not really realized.
Well, you probably have a really good ear. You know, I think that's part of it. So you were unconsciously sort of absorbing that formula, yeah?
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm just curious, what do you think about UK schools in terms of supporting music programs? Do you find that they have a good education for music or a good sort of support for music?
I think it really depends on what school you go to. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you can go to some schools and they're like, music is everything. We're going to really encourage the students, make sure everyone can play an instrument or something like that. Because even in the primary school I went into, like, it's quite a standard thing. I don't know if it's like this in America, but you get taught recorder. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if you have that.
No, it's not standard, but I've heard of that in the UK. That, yeah, you guys literally all start with the recorder.
Yeah, well, I guess it's because it's quite an easy instrument and you can also learn how to read music from it because it's quite straightforward. So, mm-hmm. like, but not every school had that. And then again, like, you go on, like, the school I went to, we had, like, 25 guitars. So everyone could play guitar at the same time, or, like, rehearsal rooms with drum kits and pianos and all the rooms. So it's, like, my school was very pro-music, which definitely would have helped. And also I met all of the people that I've been in bands with through school. But I know that other schools in the UK don't have the same, like, access to musical equipment and knowledge in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, here it's unfortunately, and you probably know this, but there's been a lot of cuts to music and arts programs in the state. So unfortunately, the schools can really no longer support, you know, music and arts programs as they used to. So, which obviously is a real tragedy. But my impression is that UK, at least, I know it's different in every school, but at least there's a little bit more of a structured, consistent program throughout the UK in terms of music and the arts.
Yeah, I mean, you have to take music up to the age of 14, 15, before you do your GCSEs. I can't remember what age that is, but like, it's like mandatory to do music, art and drama. So like, it really does mean that kids have access to it. And also there are so many government schemes, I guess, in a way to put it, more like council, local councils, that really want to get people into doing music, so they'll make up their own funding, especially organizations like PRS, which is the UK royalty distribution, and they put thousands and thousands of pounds into funding the, you know, music projects or Help Musicians UK or just like all of these things. There's so many organizations that want to encourage people to get into music.
That's great. That's great. I wish we had more of that here. So let's talk about you, about going forward. So, you know, you're learning guitar, you're starting to write your own music. How did the future music career start to form for you?
I think it's one of those things that I've always saw myself as doing music, but I didn't see myself as a musician. Up until my teens, I thought I was going to go into like engineering, like, you know, satellites and cars and like that kind of engineering. I didn't think I'd be end up going into music engineering. So it wasn't something that I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to out and out do. But I think what really made the difference of me getting into music as a profession is I was in a band with a bunch of my school friends. And this was the second band that I started or like was part of. And we were doing like ukulele folk stuff. It was the height of Florence and the Machine and Mumford and Sons and, you know, that kind of era. And so we, you know, we're like, we're going to start our own folk band as well. And we did, and it did quite well. And we ended up changing the name and becoming a bit more pop. And when I was like 16, 17, I ended up dropping out of school with another one of the band members, another two of the band members, and that was called Delora. And we ended up doing all right out of that. We were working with some major record labels. And, so, you know, in my naive young arrogance, I decided to drop out of school when I was like 17 with two of the other band members so that we could do the band full time, which was quite a bold move, and I'm surprised the parents supported it. But my head of sixth form really didn't support me leaving the school. Or she just didn't really support me doing music, which was a bit of a, just, it just wasn't fun leaving. But I remember one time she pulled me out of assembly and just started having a go at me. I'd never had a conversation with her at all before, and I was in like first year of sixth form. And she was like, you're never going to amount to anything. You've got to get your head out of the clouds. You're never going to be a star. The only way to make it in life is to go to university and get a real job. You can't be a musician. And I was like, oh my God, like, I don't even know you. Like, you don't even know me. Like, how can you say this to someone? And then right there and then I was like, okay, well, I'm going to leave the school then. And then walked to my tutor and he signed me out. And then I left by the end of the week.
Wow, that's a crazy story. I mean, and if you think about it, like for us, 17 is typically when you graduate from high school. So you would, at 17, you're basically free to either go to college or start whatever career. So, yeah, so it's sort of like this person really, like, I think, was really inappropriate in terms of, well, it doesn't sound like it was about really about your welfare, but just that this person determined that there was no way you could make it. It sounds like, you know, one of those, have you heard like the term shadow artist, like frustrated artist?
Yeah.
You know, where it's like they sort of project onto you their own whatever insecurities or failings as an artist. And it's like, you know, and I've heard that a lot, especially in academia. It's, you know, that sometimes your worst critic or enemy can be actually the person that ostensibly is supposed to support you, like a teacher or counselor or something like that. So did this encounter make you kind of more determined to make it? Like, what was that about?
I think it definitely has influenced some elements, but I was so already like convinced by the age of 17 that I was going to do music and music production that it didn't really sway it. It was more like I was questioning why I was even bothering staying in school anyway. So, I mean, like at that point, the band, we would get a lot of time off school to do like radio interviews or magazine photo shoots and like being in the studio and like got gigs the night before and like stuff like that. We were working ridiculous hours. Like we might do a whole day of school and then have to leave, do a show in London, not get back till 2 a.m. the next morning, then have to get up at 7 to go to school for the next day for our exams. You know, like, it was, like, wild.
Do you mind, just for our listeners, because I think people are going to want to know, like, well, how did you get the radio interviews and how did you get the promotion and how did you raise the profile of your band to start getting all this interest? Like, was it social media? Was it word of mouth? Was it just doing a lot of gigs?
I think when we started out, we were a bit different because we went into the UK folk scene, which is actually quite big. And most of the UK folk scene is like very male dominated and especially like older male. So when a bunch of 16-year-old girls, like a four-piece 16-year-old girl band came in with a bunch of ukuleles and original songs, I think people just were like, oh, okay. And then like word of mouth spreads a bit quickly in that scene. But honestly, I think a big difference is my mum. She had like a bit of experience working with that band that I spoke about when I was younger, but she ended up being like a photographer and doing lots of other stuff. But when she saw my band, she really, really liked it. And so she kind of got on board and helped us book gigs and things like that. But she, again, like as a career perspective, she's a really interesting person because she didn't have any knowledge, didn't have any experience or anything like that, just like a pure drive and determination. So she'd be like, okay, I want to get on this radio show. Let's find out who the presenter and the producer are. Okay, let's see. I'm going to listen to their show, make sure I'm like on it, you know, retweeting, commenting, messaging in to prove that I'm listening to the show, but make them know that like she's a fan of the show and then approach them and be like, oh, by the way, I'm working with this band that I think you might like. And that's how she's completely done her whole business model. And she ended up setting up a folk record label. But that was, you know, like that's, she did that when she was like 45. Like she just decided to do that. And I find that really inspiring.
Yeah, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, so that's how the band ended up getting a lot of the contacts and things like that, was through her being a complete badass.
That's awesome. I love that. I'm curious if you think that there's more openness in the UK to new or emerging acts. I feel like there is, just in when I listen to my very limited exposure to like BBC Radio 1, but you know, they have like, you know, the BBC Radio 1 Introducing and a couple of radio programs like Annie Mac or Hugh. Is it Hugh Stevens that's like dedicated to sort of finding unknown or unsigned acts? Do you find that to be true in your experience, or is it more sort of, because you're dealing with a smaller pool, it's more sort of fiercely competitive?
I think it's really supportive. I think people have acknowledged, especially in this world of social media and everything, that you need everyone to be supporting each other, or at least that's what I feel. Like, so loads of people I'm fans of or are fans of me, like, I'll make sure I always share what they're doing, or like they'll make sure that they share what I'm doing. I think having a platform, so obviously the UK is just so much smaller than America anyway, so it can be centralized to having the BBC, which covers the whole country, and that's like the biggest radio station, or like BBC One. Well, BBC Two is actually a bit bigger, but you know, like in that sphere. And then the fact that we do have dedicated shows to promote artists. The way it actually works is, and this is how small artists get onto big radio stations, is in each area, you know, like, it's so much smaller. But, you know, like, do you know we have, like, counties in the UK? Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like states, but, like, obviously tiny. Right. And each county has its own BBC local radio. So I'm, like, BBC Beds, Hearts and Bucks, which is, like, my county area. And then they get people on every weekend from that area and across the whole of the UK. And then they'll pick the best of the best that they think have been on the show. And then they'll put them forward for the relevant radio show. So they'll either put them on the Hugh Stevens Radio 1 show, or they'll put them on to BBC Two, which like hardly ever happens because it's such a big station. BBC Six, like, you know, like they'll put them onto the relevant shows, maybe Radio 1 Extra or like things like that. So you just have this like good filtration system to actually get people on bigger shows.
Yeah, that's great. I think it's certainly a more supportive system than in the States, where it's very, there's just one or two. Like I'm in Los Angeles, so there's maybe two small independent radio stations. I'm thinking like KCRW and Cal State Northridge, that, you know, they're college radio stations, but they have a big, you know, obviously listening LA area, so big listening, and they tend to get pretty big acts, or you want to get on those radio stations, but the ones owned by the big corporate like Capital Radio or et cetera, it's like virtually impossible to get. There's no door to knock on, literally, you know what I mean? It's just this huge faceless conglomerate that doesn't want anything to do with you unless you're signed to Sony or Universal or something like that.
Yeah, of course. Like, there's definitely that mentality that acts that do get through are ones that are signed, and they give the impression that they're not, but they often actually are. The ones that get playlisted through BBC Introducing are signed.
But, oh, interesting, huh? But
they don't reveal that they're signed until a bit later on.
Mm-hmm, that's funny. So to continue with your rock star story, so you left school and you're doing this band and you're getting, you know, decent exposure and you're starting to get more and more attention. What happened?
Well, I think a like kind of pivotal thing is that because of the band, I mean, I went to some of the like most amazing studios in the UK, and just working around and like being around the studio engineers and stuff like that. And when the other two girls were like sitting on the sofa on their phones or whatever, I was always like over the shoulder of the engineer being like, what does that do? What does that do? What does that do? And I think that's really where it came to light how much I'm interested in music technology. And I didn't realize, but also that I didn't realize that my dad did it at a young age. Like, I didn't realize that's what he was until I was older, which seems really dumb, but that just kind of is what it is, which is so silly.
No, that's really fascinating. I like that. That's cool. So do you think it was because you had this interest too of like engineering and in school that it was almost like left brain, right brain kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, I think becoming a producer became quite a natural step because I was really into like the techie side of thing, and I'd do the band demos and like I would experiment with some of my own music and stuff like that. But then by being a producer rather than just an engineer, it's often required that you might get involved in the songwriting. Usually you have to be a multi-instrumentalist to actually like put other layers onto the track and stuff like that. So it kind of grew from there. And the way I actually like made being a producer a profession was because alongside doing the band at the same time, I'd maybe like meet someone at an open mic and like get them into the recording. But the first person I ever recorded, I did their EP for free because I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I'm going to have to go. And I did 7 tracks for their first EP. And then the next person I did, I was like, oh, look, here's an EP that I've done. And I charged them £10 a song. and they did 5 songs, so I had 50 quid. Then I was like, I'm going to use that 50 quid to buy a better microphone. And so I did. And then I was like, oh, now for a better microphone, I can charge £20. So then I charged £20 a song. And then it kind of has just exponentially gone up. And I've just reinvested any money that I made straight back into my gear to justify charging more.
Tell us about the gear that you had. First of all, were you recording out of your house? Like, was this a home studio?
I mean, it still kind of is. The studio I work at is, I work at a studio now and I have my own studio. It's kind of, I guess, a glorified shed in a way, but I was really lucky because my stepdad built this like thing at the bottom of the garden, this room, and it was meant to be like a party room. And so it has like strobes and lasers. It's really small. It's not massive. It's just like, he just wanted his like basically man cave, and it had like big speakers and everything like that. And when I was doing the band rehearsals and stuff like that, I would start commandeering the den, as we called it, and we would start doing band practice in there. Then I would start bringing more of my equipment down, then I moved my computer down there, and then like my whole rig there. And I had like the worst setup. Like, the first things I ever recorded were recorded on Audacity through my laptop, you know? And I learned so much actually doing that, which kind of surprises me. But yeah, my equipment grew more and more as time went on.
What was your, did you use like Logic or Pro Tools?
So the first thing that I used was Cubase 5.
Oh yeah, okay.
I think it's because at the school they didn't teach music technology, and then a bunch of students like rallied up to be like, we don't want to leave this school, but we want to learn music technology. And so the school had like old versions of Cubase, so we used that, and that's how I learned. So naturally I was like, oh, I'm going to use Cubase on my computer. I just had like this little digital converter that would take two jacks in, like a stereo jack pair, and then it would USB to your computer. And then I used like a live passive desk, analog desk, and I would plug the microphone into the mixing desk. And then I would take the stereo out from the mixing desk to put it into the two track converter. And then I would record into Cubase like that. And I could use like two microphones at once if I wanted, by like panning them left and right and then recentering them to mono in the software after I imported the two channel strip, which was kind of really long. And then I eventually ended up getting like I got a Tascam interface, which I actually still use sometimes now, which like made a huge difference to my recording.
Nice. So were you doing like acoustic recordings and just sort of more of the mixing and mastering, or were you taking more of an active hand in producing and adding sort of your own style or bells and whistles, things like that?
I definitely was like, I'm here to start to finish. Like, I'll be there and we'll listen to your tracks, see which ones we think are the good ones, think if we can change any of the songwriting in them. And then like we'll get their track down as the main bass. And then I would then start adding additional production, like bass or another guitar or mandolin or ukulele or harmony, is like depending on what they wanted. And then I would mix. I wouldn't master so much unless someone really wanted me to master, because I think even from an early stage, I noticed the advantage of getting someone else to master a track, because they can also point out things that might be wrong in the song. So yeah, it was kind of like a one-stop shop, which was like quite a nice person to be. I liked having the control and the creativity, but I was also in the band along the same time I was doing this as well and getting to perform, which was really good.
Did you find any experience of producing, and I've just heard this before, so I'm curious if you had this experience, where sometimes artists would kind of treat you like a fast food menu? Like, be like, I want this, 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 and this, and I want it to sound like this, and I want this and this, and you're like, okay, well, let's see what we have to work with, kind of thing.
I would say almost every artist comes in,
yeah,
like everyone, like you. It's very rare that you either come in with an artist that say, I want to sound like this super slick, amazing production, incredibly well written song or album that someone else has done, and it's like, you just can't achieve that because you don't have content in the first place. And then the other side of that is when people come in and say, I don't want any production. I just want my songs recorded the way that they are, and just want them recorded well, which is easy and fine. But at the same time, it's quite hard to be like, you know, it might sound really good. It's like, you know, some variety. Or like, it's quite hard to like find the balance, but I find practically all of my job is just managing expectations and trying to help people achieve what they want to achieve.
Do you feel like it takes a certain amount of maybe good instinct or confidence to relay that to the artist, so you don't feel like you're just sort of getting steamrolled or treated like a fast food drive-through?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference that maybe some of the experiences I had to other producers, especially my age, was that I was like an artist, or I still am, alongside, and I was a young girl in the studio, in the vocal booth, and there might be like three guys sitting behind the mixing desk looking at their phones or whatever, and I'd be in there and I'd finish the take and they wouldn't even realize the take is finished and stuff like that. And I think some of those experiences really relayed to when I was in the studio. So I know that, like, as soon as the take is finished, you need to give immediate validation, like well done, you did a good take, or like, you know, that was great, or just like anything to just acknowledge the artist. Because as soon as you make them doubt their confidence, or like make them feel bad or anything, like, you've wrecked any future takes for a while until you bring the energy back. So a lot of it is just like managing people, making sure they're feeling good and everything like that. And I think without being an artist on the other side of the booth, I don't think I would be as, like, I don't think I'd be able to do it the way that I do it now.
Are you still performing? Are you still in this band?
The band broke up like three years ago now. And after the band, I just decided that I wanted to be a session guitarist and songwriter and producer, to just keep it, you know, just keep on all the things I really like. I like writing songs, so I can still do that. I like performing, so I still get to be on stage. And I love engineering and production, so it was like a perfect thing. And I ended up going on some really awesome tours and playing some massive shows with that, like, mentality, and getting some co-writes on some nice songs. So it worked really well. But in like March of 2017, I started working with this publishing company, and they really wanted me to be an artist. And I was like, of course not, I'm not going to be an artist, are you joking? Like, I'd never really sung before, I'd never like been the front person in a band. Like, I was just like, no, you're joking. And then a couple of months later, they're like, you know, I really think you should. And at the same time, my mum was like, I think you should do it. And I'm like, are you joking? That's like the hardest thing to be, and I'm like, don't have the right attitude for it and everything like that. Anyway, March 2017, I launched my own solo artist project under the name Dee Dee, which kind of sparked off a lot of the, like, songwriting and gigging and getting back into the scene. So that was a lot of fun.
That's so cool. So the publishers were like, look, they would know, right? I mean, their time is money. They're not just going to sort of like bullshit you. So obviously they felt that you have something to offer. You have something really valuable to offer.
I think that's what part of the appeal was knowing that, like, if a legit company thought that I would be good at being an artist, then maybe I should. And I think also a lot of the skills that I learned, like, I did a lot of like helping artists with their branding and like all of that kind of stuff. I think that really showed me, basically, I was like, you should do this with your artist project to other people. I was like, you should do this, 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 and this. And half the time they wouldn't do it. And I'm like, that's fair. Everyone's got their own lives. I think when I then had the prospect of doing the artist project, I was like, I better put my words into practice and see if they actually work. And within the first year, like, it went so much better than I even could have imagined. I'm still obviously a tiny artist, but I, on the scale of like new independent artists, it just went crazy.
So can you give us a little taste of what you were telling other artists, just for our listeners who are trying to kind of break out? Like, what are some of the tools or tips that you yourself are now using to promote yourself as an artist?
I think one of the more clear things when you come across any of my like artist stuff under my Dee Dee name is the branding. I think if you immediately have a recognizable, solid branding, then you're one step above anyway, because people recognize you. So all of my branding is like the seafoam green with checkers and then a pink stripe through it. And that particular branding model can be used on anything like in that variation, and people know it's me. People just send me pictures of Checkers now, like when they see something checkered, and I'm like, yes, I really got that branding down.
Nice. Yeah, so it's something that's easily recognizable, and it's sort of like establishing a consistent pattern with it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say my second tip would be, if you were wanting to be an artist, is make sure your live performance is really solid. When, you know, find not necessarily your gimmick, but find what makes you different about your performance and really nail it. Make sure you're playing your songs perfect every time. Make sure that you're like putting on a great set. Maybe you're not the best singer, but the style and energy that you have completely outweighs anything like that. Like, I think the performance side has also really made me stick out a bit.
Nice. Like, where do you see yourself? You're getting awards now for your producing work, correct? Like, tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think the first award I won as a producer was the NMG Award for Producer of the Year for 2017. And the NMG... Thanks. And that award is like a regional award. So it's for like London and East Anglia, which are like the bulgy bit on England. And so that was like insane. And after I won that award, I ended up getting booked for so many different things, for talks. Loads of people wanted to work with me. So it like really, it blew up in that sense, which was really awesome. And then last year I won the same award again for 2018. So I won the first ever version of the award, which was the 2017 one. And then I won it again for 2018. And then I also won the European Pro Sound Award or Breakthrough Studio Engineer in 2018 as well. And then I also won the NMG Award for Breakthrough Artist of the Year for 2018. So I won a lot of awards in 2018, which is really weird.
I love it. I love it. I think that's great. And it gives you, I mean, the other thing I want you to talk about is being a woman producer and what that's like, because unfortunately it's very rare. And also you have to prove yourself. And so, I mean, unfortunately or not, the fact that you have awards, whereas some bloke probably doesn't need to have awards, but you know, it's like you have to sort of do twice the amount of work. Yeah.
I felt really weird after I won the Pro Sound Awards, the European one, because obviously that's a much bigger award, because I just had like severe imposter syndrome. Like, and now with the other awards, they were really nice, but they weren't as big. And so after I won the European one, I was like, oh my God, people actually think I know what I'm doing, but I don't. It's like the thought process I kept having, which is so destructive and not useful at all. But I think that is partly like being a woman in music, because I think if I didn't have that self-doubt, I don't think I would have been worried about winning an award. Like, that's so screwed up, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, it comes from somewhere. And I think it's perpetuated that there is this need to prove over and over and over again. Like, I know what I'm doing, and I know just as much, if not more, than you.
I think it's hard to convey that. I think also an interesting like element of it was I started working in this other studio, and we worked with a lot of like rap, grime, urban music. And when these guys would walk in and see that I was the engineer for their session, they just like literally like were like, would say to my face, do you even know what you're doing? Like, before anything had started, I've had guys say that they're nervous to work with me because they don't think I know what I'm doing. And that was like 2 weeks ago. So it's sort of like, as soon as I think I've like gone over another hurdle, I get really reminded. But I see it more as a reflection on them than as me. Like, I know what I'm doing, so it doesn't really matter. It's like they're just slowing their whole process down by doubting me. I mean, by the end of it, it ended up being like, they said that it was the best session they've ever been in, but it's annoying that I had to even prove myself in the first place.
Well, what I would say to you is, and this is why I'm so grateful you're on the show, and I think there's such a necessity for women like you, because, and I don't know how it is in the UK, but you know, in LA, particularly from women artists, I hear a lot about predatory producers. Mm-hmm. So they go in for a session And there, everything's, first of all, nothing's written down, which is like the big no-no, right? Like, yeah, you need to have a contract, even if it's a text, even if it's an email, but something in writing that says, I'm going to do this for you in exchange for this, or whatever the terms are. But I've heard so many horror stories of like, yeah, I went in for this session and either he hit on me or he completely disregarded my vision for the work and did what he felt was the best production, his style, not my style. Or the worst case scenario, I can't get my master's. Yeah, like he refuses to give me my master's.
Oh my God.
Et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I'm painting a pretty bleak picture, but you know, unfortunately this is just what's happened, especially I think in Los Angeles, where there are so many artists and that don't have either, they don't know how to produce their own stuff, or again, they're sort of at the mercy of these random, mostly dudes who again are sort of like taking advantage of the situation.
Yeah. I think that happens in the UK all the time as well. I think I'd say probably about 80% of my sessions with female artists who have not worked with a female producer before, and I'm the first one they've worked with, they're like, oh my God, what? Like, you're actually listening to my suggestions? Or like, this, something that happens so often, especially in the acoustic scene, is that a female artist who plays guitar would normally play guitar for themselves, but they'll go into the studio and they'll mess up a little bit, and the guy will go, oh, just let me do it for you. And then does the guitar part for them, or ends up playing all these other instrument parts for them, but not in a way of like encouragement. Oh, I want to make your song sound good. Just in a like, oh, you're too bad at this. Like, I'm going to do it for you. Mm-hmm. I was working with like, I don't know, I probably had like 8 artists that are like this, where they were really shocked that I was going to get them to play guitar on it. And they were like, yeah, but I'll probably make loads of mistakes. And I'm like, yeah, well, like, we'll work through it. Like, I think it's really important that you have the pride in the fact that you played an instrument, you know, your own instrument on the track. And like, they do, they leave with so much pride and happiness in the track. And I've never had anyone leave that has gone, oh, I'm not happy with that, and redone it somewhere else. But the amount of times I've had to redo some other guy's track because the artist isn't happy with it in the first place.
Yeah. And I think that that's huge, because again, yeah, your work is supposed to support the artist, not overshadow, not dictate, but support their vision from a producer standpoint.
Yeah, exactly. Your job is to try take what is in the artist's head and make it into audio out loud. Like, your job is just to facilitate. It's not there to like, it's not your thing, it's their thing, you know, and you make something together.
Yeah, that's huge. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time, but we've done it. And why don't you just let our listeners know how they can, like, tell us about your artist side, your producer side, how people can get in touch with you, how they can follow you, how to find you.
Awesome. So my most active platform is probably Instagram or Twitter. My handle for all of my music production is @LaurenD_D, or you can find me, Lauren Deacon Davis. And then my artist project is @IAMDIDI Music. And nice. That's on every platform. You'll be able to find that. My music is more like pop punk, like wannabe Paramore.
Oh, fun. And so your artist name is Dee Dee.
Yeah, Dee Dee.
Okay, cool. That's so cool. And are you on Spotify and Apple Music and streaming platforms like that?
I had an EP that came out in November that I co-produced with my friend Rihanna Meyer, and all the tracks are out there and you can find them. And yeah.
What's the name of the EP?
The EP is called Green. And if you type in Dee Dee Green, it should come up on the internet.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Lauren. I so appreciate you speaking to me all the way from across the pond, and I'm really, really proud and inspired by you.
Oh, thank you. You're incredible too.
You guys, I just have the best guests on this show. I'm so grateful to Lauren that she took the time to be on. Hey, how'd you get that music job? And I think everyone should just keep an eye out for her, because I know she is just going to continue to light up and go places. So to follow her again, it's Lauren Deacon Davies
Her website is laurendeakindavies.com, LaurenDeakindavies.com. Again, her handles are at Lauren, LaurenD_D, or her artist name, Dee Dee. She is at imddmusic, D-I-D-I music. Okay, my loves, thus ends, I cannot believe this, we are up to episode 50 of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? And again, we could not have done this without you, so thank you so much again for your continued love and support. So, so grateful to you. I am your host, hostess with the mostest, L. Ariel, and I am on the interwebs at lariel.music.com. That's my website, or you can follow me on the Twitter, the Instagram, at lariel.music. We are also, the podcast is also on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Music Jobs Podcast. That's Music Jobs with an S podcast. Follow, say hi, tell me what's going on. So I want you to keep on hustling, keep on rocking and rolling in 2019. And remember, you are going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.